this will end. We don't want people to think that it's in despair. If it's never going to end, we're always going to be this way. We might as well just go out and do what we want to do. We have vaccines that look quite promising in the sense of by November or December, we likely will know whether we have a safe and effective vaccine.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology builds?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hello, everyone. Welcome, and thank you for joining us on The Tightrope. This is a place where we engage in tough and ever tougher issues and try to have a serious dialogue and keep our balance. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my dear friend and co-host, Dr. Cornel West, and we have an extremely busy guest with us today. His time is not only limited, but it's exceptionally precious, so we're going to dive right in. We do want to say how much gratitude we have for him joining us. We're actually still a little amazed that he's joining us at all. We have Dr. Anthony Fauci with us, who has become a household name in the past 6 months as director of NIAID, that's the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the federal agency called the NIH. Dr. Fauci oversees research into the world's deadliest diseases, particularly those that affect our immune system. Since the 1980s, when he was at the forefront of the HIV and AIDS research, he's literally saved millions of lives, both here in the US and in the developing world. He's a leading advocate for science, which is something we shouldn't have to have advocates for, but we do. A leading advocate for science and truth at a time when both are seriously under attack. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to The Tightrope.
Thank you, Tricia. It's great to be with you and with Dr. West. I appreciate your inviting me.
Yes, well, it's our pleasure. So let's just jump right in because we know you're off to do some saving of somebody somewhere shortly. Tell us where you think we are now. You know, how would you describe the current situation and what should we most be focused on at this point when it comes to COVID?
Well, there are a couple of issues, Tricia. One is public health issue and the other is a scientific issue. With regard to the public health issue, you know, if you look at the map of the United States and the distribution of active cases that are going on right now, there are parts of the country that are doing very well. But what is concerning to me is that there are also parts of the country that when you look at the amount of test positivity, it's reflective and usually predictive that there are going to be more surges. Right now, our baseline of cases per day are 40,000 cases per day, and it's been that way for quite a while. We are going into the fall and winter season when one of the ways that you can prevent infection remaining outdoors and doing function outdoors is going to become much more difficult and problematic. And so I would have liked to have seen as we enter the more difficult season, that we bring down that level of infection very far lower than 40,000 a day, somewhere in a couple of thousand, so that when we get the inevitable appearance of new cases as we get into a more difficult season, that we could handle them by doing the proper containment of identification, isolation, contact tracing. But when you have community spread that's of the level that's accounting for 40,000 cases a day, it makes the task more difficult. So that's the reason why I do what I do. I get on any way I can to get public attention and talk about the importance of the fundamental things we can do to prevent surges, uniform wearing of masks, avoiding crowds, maintaining distances, 6 feet at least, doing things outdoors, preferentially over indoors. And I mean, you want to stay away from crowded bars indoors where people are not wearing masks. Those are the things that trigger the super spreading. And washing your hands as often as you can. They seem so simple, Tricia, but yeah. People are not doing them. That's the point. We've got to make sure we uniformly go into the season on a much better footing than we're in right now.
It just seems to me there's a spiritual decay in the country in terms of people just not caring about each other, people not being concerned enough about each other. How does one deal with that as a scientist? And it just strikes me as you have been very distinctive as a scientist because you're so deeply grounded in humanity and humanitarian sensibility, grounded in a Jesuit education, grounded in all that love coming out of the Italian-American communities going back to the old country. How do you deal with that spiritual decay? Because you can say so many, you can say what you said on TV over and over again, but if our fellow citizens don't care enough for each other,
what
do you do, my brother?
Yeah, well, Dr. West, you bring up a very good point. I have been maintaining a positive, optimistic attitude that when the country, which fundamentally, you know, is made up mostly of good people, appreciate the point that you're making, which I think in some respects, Dr. West, it is inadvertent and innocent. They don't appreciate that when they get infected. Right now, it's the younger people that are driving the infections. We know that when you look at the age bracket of the new infections. It's people who are the nature of the disease. They see that if you're young and you get infected, the chances of your getting a serious consequence of disease is very low. That's just a fact. It's a strange disease. You know, you have 40% of the people don't have any symptoms. Those who do get symptoms, most of them are mild. And then you have a subgroup, the elderly and people at any age who have underlying conditions, diabetes, obesity, heart disease, lung disease, their risk of getting a serious consequence is great. Whereas if you're young, your risk in reality is low. So therefore you could understand how a person who's a young person that says, I don't like being cooped up. I want to go out. I want to party. I want to go to a bar. I don't care about wearing a mask, because they say, I worry about myself. If I get infected, I'll take my risk. What they're missing the fact that you're getting infected, you are inadvertently propagating the outbreak, because even though you don't get sick, you almost certainly have the possibility of giving it to someone else inadvertently and innocently. I don't think anybody wants to do it deliberately, who then infects someone else, who then ultimately infects a vulnerable person. That can be someone's grandfather. That can be someone's wife on chemotherapy for cancer. That could be an immunodeficient child. That could be an African-American youngster with sickle cell disease who, when they get infected, they will have a very severe consequence. So we've got to try and engender in people not only the personal responsibility for yourself, but to understand that you have a societal responsibility to others. It isn't only about you. You're part of the outbreak if you allow yourself to get infected. So I try, and I'm not so sure how successful I have been, but I'm not going to stop trying to get people to understand we have to be all in this together. We can't say, I'm in a vacuum, I don't care. If we want to get out of this, we've got to do it together. And I don't mean shutting down the country again. I don't mean that at all. I mean prudently and carefully trying to open up the country. So public health measures should not be an obstacle to opening the country. It should be a safe gateway vehicle roadway to opening up the country again. So it shouldn't be that public health is the enemy. The virus is the enemy. It's not the public health endeavors. We've just got to get people to try and understand that.
Right, right. This is really an interesting line of thinking, because it's not only about relationships, it's also about understanding the way in which the disease is in the driver's seat. And it reminds me of something you said right after President Trump was imagining that we were going to open the country in Easter and the churches were going to be, you know, packed with people. And this was supposed to be a happy image, not a terrifying disaster image. And you said the disease decides when society can open up. And no pronouncements can do that. And you went on to describe, I think you were on CNN or something along those lines, and you went on to describe how important it is to follow what's going on with the disease from both a scientific perspective and a spreading perspective. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I think in addition to people being potentially selfish, they also perhaps don't grasp the complexity of the science involved and why their decisions are so important.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. So it gets back to what we were saying months ago in the context of the scenario that you just described very accurately, Tricia, about when you're in a situation where you have a certain level of infection in the community, that inevitably, scientifically, this isn't just opinion, if you do not do things in a careful, prudent way, you will invite spread of infection, because that's the way infection works. It isn't opinion, it's scientific fact that that's the case. So what we were saying back then, you remember, that when you wanted to open up, we would have a process. It was called Opening America Again. And it was a gateway that you've got to get the level of infection down to a certain level. When you do, you open up a little bit more in phase one. If you get through that for a while, you open up a little bit more in phase two. What happened is that some states, cities, regions decided they wanted to skip over one or two of the phases, and the inevitable happened. You had a big surge. Whereas if it had been done gradually, okay. But the other thing that happened, I think, gets to what Dr. West was alluding to, that even when mayors and governors were trying to do it correctly, the people in the community were saying, I don't really care. I want to do it my way. So science is going to tell you what's going to happen if you do one thing or another. Believe it. Now, one thing I do want to get across is that this will end. We don't want people to think that it's in despair. If it's never going to end, we're always going to be this way. We might as well just go out and do what we want to do. We have vaccines that look quite promising in the sense of by November or December, we likely will know whether we have a safe and effective vaccine. And at that point, you can start in a gradual process to give it to the vulnerable people, the healthcare workers who are at risk, as well as the elderly and those who have underlying conditions. We're not going to have enough immediately to give to everybody, but graded over a period of months, we can do that. So, you know, the end is in sight, because once you have a vaccine combined with some modest, acceptable public health measures, we can bring the level of infection way down. And then people can start doing the things you need to do, like getting businesses open again, getting the economy back, getting people back to doing what they need to do safely, such as being in school and going to your job. We need to impress upon people that that is doable. It's within our power to do it. So don't give up and be despair and say, it doesn't matter. Why don't we just go and do what we want to do? Hang in there.
Right, right. Well, see, this class is about hope on the tightrope. And you provide strong language of sustaining that hope. But, you know, like another great product of a Jesuit education, I'm thinking of Shakespeare juxtaposed to you as a product of Jesuit education, that he seems to have less faith in the goodness of people than you do. That he's got a darker conception of how human beings actually are. And when I think of you working with our president, you know, Brother Trump himself, who just strikes me as lacking in integrity, lacking in decency, lacking in honesty, how do you negotiate and navigate that relation? I think you've been on the tightrope for a good while, and you've done a wonderful job. But is it that your faith in the goodness of persons is so all-embracing that you hold on to hope? Or are you actually more Shakespearean in the closet and recognize you've got some conceptions of darkness into who we are, given your Jesuit education. Now, that echoes that. You know what I mean? I think of John Regis. You went to Regis High School. He's right in the middle of the bubonic plague, right? He's with all the marginalized people. He's going against the grain in such a radical way. How do you do it, Dr. Fauci, my dear brother?
Well, my brother, Dr. West, to stick with your comparisons, I think I'm more like John Francis Regis than I am Shakespeare. In that I do look upon the good side of people. I do believe that the goodness of the American people, the American spirit, will come through. But I'm also a realist, sir. I'm not somebody who is just thinking that everything is going to be good and great spontaneously. Right. I think you have to work for it. So the way I work in my sphere is I try and continue to be highly consistent, transparent in basing what I say on the scientific data and information as it exists now. One of the problems when you're dealing with an evolving situation, like an evolving pandemic, that there are many unknowns, and often you have to make an educated guess about what the best way to go is. And then when the data prove you right or wrong, you stick with the data. You say, now it's confirmed. Or, you know, we thought it was this way, but the data are now telling us it's a bit different. Don't be afraid to stick with the data and be humble enough and modest enough to know that we're all in a learning process. We don't know everything we needed to know when this first happened. And I'll guarantee you, Dr. West, that 2-3 months from now, there will be things that we learned that we don't know now. And you just got to keep understanding to go with the data and the evidence. That will be the best anyone can do.
That segues to something I've really been wanting to ask you, which is, you know, how you felt about the presidential debates. In particular, the way you got name checked, but also the confusion around it, and how much that speaks to what you just said, right? Because it seemed as if both Biden and Trump were unable to be clear about the fact that the situation could change without there being a lack of knowledge. It was almost as if because information was changing, that was being used to claim that there was no clarity of the situation. So can you talk a little bit about, I'm assuming you saw the debates, and it was too much. It was way too much. It was way over the top. But I guess, you know, there were so many moments where, you know, it was saying, well, first he said, Dr. Fauci said this, and then he said that. At first it was masks, and then it wasn't. So there seemed to be a different interpretation of what you just described. So can you respond to what you heard and how you want people to clarify?
Yeah. In fact, what needed the clarification was exactly what I was just explaining to both you and to Dr. West. So let me quickly go through it. And I think I could do it quickly. Early on in the outbreak, there were several things we did not know. The one thing we did know was that the healthcare workers were short of personal protective equipment, including masks. So when the question came up, should people be going out and buying and hoarding masks with the possible consequence that there wouldn't be enough masks for the healthcare workers who needed masks because they were putting themselves in danger every day of taking care of people. So we made a recommendation that we shouldn't be wearing masks back then. There were several things we didn't know. We didn't know how effective masks were, number one, and therefore, the recommendation could not be strong about wearing a mask. So what did we learn that changed us from saying, we don't think you should be wearing a mask, to everybody should be wearing universally a mask? Several things happened. One, we found out that cloth coverings were just as good as the surgical masks. So you could make your own cloth covering, and anybody out there who knows anything about material could make a mask. So the shortage situation disappeared, number one. Number two, the other thing we learned, and that's important, is that masks actually work, because the data was not in. But when we started to examine the data, the meta-analysis made it clear that if you wear a mask, you will be protecting yourself from transmitting and from being infected. Number three, we did not know that 40 to 50% of the infections are without symptoms. And in fact, the people who are without symptoms have a significant effect on transmitting infection to someone who doesn't have an infection. So therefore, it became compelling if you don't even know you're infected and you don't know that somebody else is infected, the thing to do is wear a mask. That's what you need to do. Wear a mask. And this is a typical cotton mask that was made by a fabric company. So what happens? Yeah. We're not taking the masks away from the healthcare workers. Now we know that masks work. We didn't know it then. Now we know that this infection spreads from asymptomatic people. Therefore, when we say everyone should wear a mask, we mean because you might be infected and you might not even know it. So the reason to wear a mask is really a societal responsibility to prevent you from infecting someone. And when they wear a mask and you wear a mask, they can prevent them from infecting you. That's the reason why things have changed. Not because we were wrong then or right now. It's because we went by the knowledge we had at that time. And that's what got confused in the back and forth during the debate.
Yeah, it was more than confused, that's for sure.
No, but you just got this wonderful scientific temper, which is deeper than tied to scientific method, because science itself can become dogmatic. But a scientific temper of just being fallible, let's see what the evidence says, let's proceed based on the evidence, and let's be honest and candid about it. But I just come back to this question again, though. How do you sustain your upbeat cheerfulness in such a sad moment? Maybe it's Dante, the greatest of all Christian poets. Look unflinchingly at the ugliness and the grimness and still have a visionary impulse that sustains you, like in the Paradiso, that third moment of the Divine Comedy. How do you sustain that, especially given the fact that you're dealing with our president? I know it must be so frustrating. I know it's got to be full of tremendous comes and goes and ups and downs, and yet you come with a smile to your fellow citizens and say, this is what the science says, I have faith in you, and we're going to get through it.
You know, Dr. West, there's no other alternative than what I'm doing. I can't give up. This is too important a problem for us as individuals, for our society, and for the world. So as difficult as things get, giving up, throwing your hands up and saying it's too frustrating is not an option. And I never, ever consider it as an option. No matter how difficult things get, you have to keep doing what you're doing. And I'm not the only one that does it. Everyone has a role in this, and there are people who are doing very, very important things. As a scientist, I just stick by my role as a scientist and letting the science direct what I do, the way I think, and what I talk about. And sometimes in an environment you're in, that's difficult. But as I mentioned, the option of not doing it doesn't exist.
We're just grateful you have the courage to continue to do it, because you've inspired me. Plus, I was glad to see the mask you had on was acceptable, because that's the kind I wear. So now I'll be okay, because that N95, I can't barely breathe. But I wanted to mention to our viewers and listeners that you have a new audio, I guess it's called an audio biography, coming out called Fauci on Audible. But there was a particular moment where the narrator was talking about a very significant turning point during the HIV era, before a lot was known and when everyone was extremely both afraid and often deeply violently mistreating the gay community. You specifically mentioned that you were disturbed by the government showing so little concern for the gay community, but also what you learned at that moment that changed you. Can you give us a little bit more than that, you know, to what actually happened there and how might that moment have impacted the way you're approaching COVID now or human nature or approaching governments now?
You know, what it was, Trisha, it was important. It was mostly the gay community back then had such important good points of truth that A, they were not being listened to, and the government scientists and regulators and officials were essentially dictating how you approach an outbreak that involved them. And they wanted to be part of the discussion. They wanted to be at the table and no one listened to them. So they became very iconoclastic. They became very provocative, very theatrical. And it had the effect of they wanted to gain attention. But what it did is got everybody to pull back from them because they became afraid. That's not the way the very, what's the right word back then, button-down community of scientists and regulators acted. So what I did was, and this may be to something that Dr. West mentioned, whether it was something that was part of my training from my family, from my Jesuit training of service to others, I became very empathetic with them and said, rather, even when they were attacking me, I mean, they were really attacking me, writing articles, you know, one of the great iconic activists of all time, Larry Kramer, my dear friend who recently passed away, was writing articles calling me a murderer, calling me an incompetent idiot because I was not listening to them. So what I said, instead of getting angry with them, I said, let me put the theater aside. Let me put the provocative things aside and listen to what they were saying. Mm-hmm. And when I listened to what they were saying, it made perfect sense. And I felt that if I were in their shoes, I would be doing exactly the same thing as they were doing. So I did something that turned everything around. Instead of running away from them, I invited them into my metaphoric tent. And I said, let's sit down and talk about it. And that began a dialogue that to this day has been very, very productive, because what they contributed to the effort, including the scientific effort, was extraordinary. They brought things up to me that I became even ashamed of being a part of it, when the rigidity of the process would prevent you from getting on a drug because the protocol said you couldn't be on a drug, even though being on that drug would not damage any other knowledge that you would have. It would have to be done in a pristine, perfect way. So I turned myself around and I became part of the activist group. And to me, that was one of the best things I've ever done.
Oh, indeed. I'm just building on Sister Trisha's point, though. You know, it's just so wonderful to see somebody who is such a unique combination of the sharpness of a scientific mind and the goldenness of a decent heart. Because science tends to be associated too much with arrogance and condescension and a certain kind of elitism of a pejorative sort, of looking down on the unscientific. And those with a decency of heart can also be anti-scientific and be suspicious of any claims having to do with nature of reality that seem to be painful and problematic. And you're able to bring those together at this unprecedented moment in the history of the country where the pervasive spiritual decay and moral decline and the greed and the avarice and the hatred and the contempt, all of that happening at the same time. And so I just hope and pray that you recognize just the crucial role that you are playing for so many of us, because we are down and out. We're fighting too. We've got our hope on the tightrope, but sometimes a little bit more Shakespearean than John Francis Regis and Anthony Fauci. But we just want you to know that, really.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
We know you have to go, but I just want to close by saying that we're so honored to have you here with us, but also to really confirm that we need both of these things, data, science, and human compassion. You can't really move without both of those things together. So I completely see you as a real life superhero. You've totally pumped me up to go on fighting and to not be despairing, because it's a very difficult time for so many reasons. So we so appreciate you. We just honor you, and you know you're welcome anytime we can. You want to be on the tightrope with us or anywhere else with us, we're happy to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tricia. I appreciate your inviting me. Dr. West, it's great to be with you anytime. I love what you're doing. Hang in there together. Keep praying for me, will you?
We will, for
absolutely.
Sure.
And absolutely. You keep putting a smile on Stephen and Eugenia's face, your precious parents. So, but they smiling from the porch of heaven at you right now. I can tell you that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Without a doubt.
Take care of yourselves.
We'll do our best. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Wow. He's amazing. You brought out such
he's special.
Thing.
He's special. He's special brother.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a special brother now.
That's
no doubt about it.
That determination and that it's weird. It's sort of he's able to hold on to both faith in the traditional sense and faith in the scientific religious sense, right? It's a sort of usually it's one or the other, right?
It's
that's what you raised.
That
it's such a great point.
Humanistic sensibility that just cuts to the core of decency and keep trying to keep track of decency. But then he's got this wonderful scientific temperament too.
Which we need.
That we must
right?
have. We have to have it. I mean, I think it was one of the great forms of weaponry that we have in the face of catastrophe. The scientific quest for truth, nature, reality, what is the case, how do we proceed, and so on. But
yeah.
You were marvelous again with your questioning and your orchestration of the flow of the questions, I'm telling you.
Well, thank you
so.
Now. Thank you. But, you know, I mean, it was amazing to hear your question. I was like, wow, I wouldn't have thought of that. That was a moment where I got to be in the back door of the Cornell West mind. I was like, oh, yeah. That's a really good, I can't wait to see him answer that. Because I was all about, like, we got to fix this problem and figure out what the Sam heck's going on around here.
Those questions are crucial. They really are. But you can see.
Yeah.
He brings this very rich tradition and traditions,
yes.
You know, from Italy and Catholicism at its best. And he still has a humanist who's critical of, you know, organized
yeah.
forms. And yet, at the same time, he's got his eye on the better angels of his fellow citizens and his fellow human beings. And
yeah.
that's a courageous thing, especially nowadays.
I know. It's a whole generation. He's going to be 80 this year. It's a whole generation we really need to be paying attention to. There's some kind of grit, determination, wisdom, insight. Same thing with Sonny Rollins. You know, I mean, they're only a decade apart, but that same kind of, you know, combination of grit and hope. You know, and just it's not fantasy. I mean, they really capture it.
Oh, it's so true. That's interesting you compare him to Brother Sonny, though, because...
I felt very similarly, kind of like ready to go.
You
like,
feel,
okay.
It's true. It's true.
You know what I mean? It's an emotional thing they create when he's talking. I'm like, yeah, it's amazing. And Noam Chomsky was the same thing. You know, we came out of that like amazed and dazed and like, oh, okay, climate change. We need to get ourselves on the right track, but a sense of, you know, his hope for the young people. So it's a nice, there's just a real spiritual, practical, pragmatic faith and hope all coming together.
Well, you figure all three of them were born, you know, with the war, depression, unbelievably grotesque levels of wealth inequality, Jim Crow and Jane Crow,
right.
Apartheid and South Africa, European imperialism in Africa and so forth. And here they are now still around in 2020
and
to bear witness
Noam,
in
know,
such
a
wonderful
Jew,
way.
You know, the Nazis.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You got the Jewish Shoah and Holocaust. And no, it's true. Very much so.
Maybe they've been here before.
We have so much to learn from them, not just in terms of their words, but their example. Very
exactly.
much so.
Yeah. And know that what they made it through, you know, we can deal with it as well. Right. In other words, they made it through with all that integrity and all that, you know, vision and commitment. And they made it through all the things you just listed. So, you know,
yeah,
there's no excuse
truth.
For us. We got to get on the right horse.
We got to get on the move. Yeah. We on the move. We're on the tightrope with the hope.
I know. That's why we're hope on a tightrope. We just put the hope for the show, but it's there.
Did a video today with Brother Brandon called Got the Hope. Got that hope.
Yeah, I saw that.
You saw that thing with the dance.
Yes, I did.
We worked on that video this morning on that hope. Every note, every groove, every funk moment. And it just flows right into what we're doing now, from the sonic to the scientific, you know?
Yeah, well, you need both. You need the theta and the theatrics, for sure, and the heart.
You got that hope in you, but you don't talk about the hope. You enact the hope, and it's in your music. That is the blues. It's a narrative of a catastrophe, lyrically expressed, but doesn't allow the catastrophe to have the last word.
This episode of The Tightrope is brought to you by Audible. So if you'd like to give Audible a try and earn a free download, head on over to audible.com/thetightropepod. Or you could text The Tightrope Pod to 500-500. All right, let's get back on the tightrope, Professor.
So we got a few minutes for our office hours, which is our little special section, where we take a topic, sometimes from the audience, sometimes related to things going on in the world, and we're ready for it to open them up. But I have to tell you a quick joke. Someone tweeted after the debate that they said, "Well, you know what? We're gonna need an extra extended office hours after this situation." I had to laugh. I was like, "Man, there's not enough hours in the day to go process all of that." Yeah, it kind of connects to what our topic is today in a weird, slightly indirect way. But I know you'll see it right away, as you always do. But we're gonna try to talk about the issue of mental health in the society in general. It is Mental Health Awareness Week, so we thought it was a good time to focus on that. But you know, there's so much crisis that it's not only an important time to be extremely mindful and attentive to people around us and people in our own lives and ourselves if we have mental health challenges, but it's also important to see that these conditions create mental health challenges. Absolutely. And that this isn't, you know, a matter of, you know, there are people over here who have mental health issues and then there are people over here who don't. It's that we're creating a world, a context where people are living with the ever-evolving crisis of mental stress, emotional stress, physical stress, and a despair about whether or not the world as they know it is going to be around for their children. I mean, this existential illness, in a sense. And so, you know, with all these catastrophes and tragedies, you know, we wanted to really sort of think about it less as an individual problem, right? And more, right, as a social phenomenon. So, and of course, we're not mental health experts, just to remind, not that anyone ever thought I was, but, I do want to say that we're going to speak from our, you know, personal experiences and reflections. And we'll have in the post for this episode, there's resources for people who want professional support. But Cornell, talk a little bit about how you see this mental health phenomenon, and also, you know, how much this connects to the tragedies in the world that we're living in and how that might affect people.
Yeah, I was just blessed to have a very high quality dialogue on the historic sources of trauma with my dear sister Joy DeGruy and Brother Michael Eric Dyson just a couple of days ago. And they were making the point, and we were making the point that you just made, that when you talk about trauma, you got to understand the historical backdrop, you got to understand the family backdrop, got to understand the community backdrop, and the societal backdrop. Now, certainly, it's also an individual thing. And if we don't have enough compassion for individuals, if we don't care enough for individuals, then we're never going to be able to get at the problem. We had to come up with ways of healing. And all of us are wounded, so we got to choose between wounded healers and wounded hurters. If we're going to be wounded healers, then we're going to be able to be sensitive to folk who are undergoing trauma. And who is that? Most of us, but especially the poor, especially the women, especially gays and lesbians, especially trans, especially working people. And so we need scientific ways of getting at the healing. We need artistic ways of getting at the healing, especially in music, but not just music. We need communal ways of getting at the healing, family ways of getting at the healing. And so, again, we come right back to this issue of spiritual decay. I mean, one of the reasons why we see the proliferation of our precious brothers and sisters who are mentally challenged on the streets is because there's no institutions there to engage in caring and healing for them. And they're dangling out there on their own. So how do we as a society have a priority of healing, especially for those who are most in need of that healing? But when you live in a society in which greed is, the dominant ideology, greed is good, might makes right, indifference to the suffering of others is rewarded, encouraged, rather than rendered a badge of shame, putting badge of shame on those folk who are indifferent. So there we just have to have a major moral and spiritual awakening around our precious mentally, fellow human beings and citizens who are wrestling with their mental health.
Lack of health, right? Or, suffering.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's very powerful framing that you were giving there about trauma and how to think about it across all of these layers, because we so often imagine that these are either genetic problems, which they may be to some degree, but that they're somehow not the product of all that we've created. But when you look at the generational alienation and fear and anxiety that's going on, you have such higher levels of anxiety and trauma in young people today. You have to start asking yourself, it's much harder to imagine that that's just an individual phenomenon. But the key here, it seems to me, is that, mental health challenges and other forms of crisis and trauma are disproportionately represented among the vulnerable. And so vulnerability is the index by which we can then see that the compounding nature of that vulnerability shows up in physical health challenges, mental health challenges, and so on. And then to add more to that, you find that those constituencies, whether they be people who have drug dependencies, whether they be people who are non-normative in terms of gender presentation, or whether or not they're poor people, that they are then they find themselves not only being more vulnerable, but then being mistreated by the medical profession, being either ignored or mislabeled or violently responded to. Many of the instances that we've seen in terms of police cases of violence going all the way back to the 80s in New York with Eleanor Bumpers, right? She had a mental health challenge. The gentleman who was, naked in the street, and the police, I can't remember exactly what happened, but it was humiliating and horrible. I can't even process all of it all the time. I literally file it away.
No, that was in Rochester with that brother in the cold, in the winter, January in Rochester.
Right. And so you see a man completely naked in the street, that vulnerability becomes the source of additional social disregard, mistreatment, and so on. So, when you start compounding these things, you realize that we have an expanded mental health crisis that is the product of the decisions we make as a society, and that we're creating mental health crises. We're not only not responding to the ones that we're responsible for encouraging, but we're creating more of it and more of it as we go. And so, there's a lot of work to be done here. And I think the critical piece is to take it off the individual. Mm-hmm. We're looking at a phenomenon that's bigger than that. Absolutely. At least that's my thinking.
No, you're right. We got to have institutions. We have to have a common life that views all of us of great value, of great dignity, and of great sanctity. Mm-hmm. And again, like you said, it's the vulnerable. And the fact that, the world, given the way it is, You know, it has the power to really push you off the cliff psychologically and spiritually. Yeah. And you have to have somebody who cares for you or loves you enough to help bring you back. All of us have to have those kinds of connections, relations, affiliations, nurturing, caring relations. And when you live in a society that's more and more characterized by massive lovelessness, then you're going to get tremendous trauma. People are already living in hell. You know, Dostoevsky defines hell in the Brothers Karamazov, those who suffer from the undercultivated capacity to love and be loved. You see? And so that's always already hell right there.
That's so true. That's so true. And, you know, right now on college campuses, there's been over the last few years, a lot of student protests have been about many things, you know, systemic racism, police brutality. But they also, in their demands, are asking for more psychological services, more access to counseling, more diverse forms of counselors with whom they feel they can share their situation. And, you know, this is, you know, a situation close to my heart because I lost my nephew to mental health issues and he committed suicide. You know, I think about all the pressure. He's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant young man, went to Harvard. And, you know, you think about the pressure on young people of color to be successful once they make it to something that's considered a certain level, and the pressure that they feel. I'm not sure people understand that the getting in is the beginning of a whole nother set of problems, right? You spend your whole life trying to get into Brown, get into Harvard, get into this, that, and the other. And, you know, are these places that people of color who are this sort of sensitive and intelligent, you know, and hardworking, can they survive these institutions healthily? I think is a real question that his death really forced me to take really heart about, you know, really to ask myself, is this a place, you know, that can protect people emotionally enough? Forget the learning part, because it's all the other things that are going on all the time.
So true. You know, the great Tennessee Williams, the playwright, wrote a powerful essay called The Catastrophe of Success. The Catastrophe of Success. And he talked about what happens when success becomes a demon that cuts off your capacity for joy and love. So no matter how high you ascend, your soul is still in the dumps. And we see in this pervasive, not just in terms of the depression, but also in terms of those who more and more find it difficult to even open themselves for intimacy. And there is no real love without intimacy and vulnerability and invincibility, you see. And so without that opening, then no matter how successful, no matter how many material toys you have, no matter how much status you have, you're still not going to have something that is worth having more than anything else, which is love and be loved, care and be cared for. You see? And so
like
that's part of what I mean by spiritual decay.
Right.
And that's part of me. That's predatory capitalism. You know, it's just squeezing all the humanity out, and it's all superficial spectacle and titillation and stimulation and all of the surface-like glitz and blitz of life. And people just want their little TLC. They just want the tender love and care, you know, as Aretha put it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny you say that, Aretha, because yesterday I was in the car and Music Soulchild song Teach Me came on, which talks about masculinity, what he didn't learn about expressing his feelings and hoping that this partner he's singing to, crooning to sensually, will help him learn how to be in that space of emotional care and openness. But, you know, you find that people who have to guard against so much hatred, hostility, mistreatment, disregard, claim that you don't belong, that you shouldn't be here, wherever that here is, you know, encourages people to shut down, because to survive it, you got to shut down. I mean, by the time you get it back open, you know, it's time for bed. If you're lucky, if you made it through the whole day, guarded enough to get home safe, right? By the time your heart's open, you done went to sleep. You know, if you're lucky.
Your heart is open and your eyes are closed.
Exactly.
I hear you.
Exactly.
You're telling the truth. You're telling the truth.
But right now in particular, it isn't just that we have a pandemic, which is just terrifying, but also increasing the vulnerability of the vulnerable. But we have such a vacuum of moral leadership, such a vacuum of guidance that would reassure us. I feel more reassured talking to Dr. Fauci for 25 minutes than I have felt ever by turning on the news to find out what the Sam Hell's been going on and what I should
do. That's true.
When you think of the combination of the sort of spiraling out of a public acceptance of white supremacy and anti-Black and brown violence as a legitimate part of the spectrum of, you know, a public political narrative, you want to talk about psychological stress. I've had at least 10 conversations since that debate where people are just literally talking about trying to leave the country. They're just it's not safe. Have you had them too?
No, it's true.
Yeah, people are back
absolutely.
To where are we going to go? Because, you know, all we're trying to do is live like everybody else. But you know, if it gets that bad, you know, you can't just live. You just can't live.
No, that's very true. That's very true. But in the end, there's nowhere to run.
Ain't that? Well, that's what I said.
Oh, we all got a death sentence in space and time. That's true for New Zealand. That's true for New York. You know what I mean? That's true for Ethiopia. It's true for Guatemala. But as America becomes more fascist, I can understand what people are saying. You know, there's some other places that are less fascist, and I only got a few years left, and I'd rather be able to at least live a life of decency there rather than to put up with all these lies and crimes in the country. And that's real.
Fear.
That's
and
very, very
fear.
Real.
Yeah. I mean, I say that not to say that I'm packing up to go anywhere, you know. I mean, although I could dial into Zoom from anywhere and do the tightrope.
We're not going to let you go now. You and Brother Andre, y'all can go to Japan or Siberia. We're going to be piped in every week, no matter what.
All right, good. I'm going to go somewhere warm. I'm going to go somewhere warm where there's sand and some kind of, you know, beach. So if you find a little bit of flecks of sand on my head on the screen, you'll know.
Oh, you're going to Fiji. You're going to Fiji then.
Tahiti. There's a thought. Or just, you know, Audre Lorde, she went back to the Caribbean. A lot of people get, you know, Max Robinson. You know, a lot of people just said they had Du Bois. I mean, not the Caribbean.
Oh, you're talking about Randall. You're talking about Randall. Randall.
I mean, Randall, not Max. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
his brother.
Yeah, no. Yeah, his brother. Yeah, he's still down there, I think.
Is he?
I think, you know, I wonder. Oh, I love my brother. I haven't talked to him in a while. I have a feeling that Randall could still be down. He's writing novels. He may have come back to D.C., but I know he did. He left in exile.
Yeah, but I mean, often people get pushed out, but then there's also the value of just the level of stress that goes down, you know. And anyway, I just think when everyday people start talking about, well, I either got to get a gun or I got to move, and they don't want to do either one, you know, there's something psychological in the zeitgeist. So I want to encourage everybody here to, you know, to really take care, right, and to give as much as they can of themselves emotionally to people around them. You know, be as generous as you can and be as mindful. And listen, you know, Fauci, the thing I took away that was so moving to me was when he said, when I pushed aside all the theatrics, you know, no matter even if you enjoy them, but when you push them aside, you listen to what, you know, these gay activists were really saying, right? He realized that there was a core truth in it and that it was important to listen to that. And that's what I would say we all need to try to do right now for each other.
Absolutely. Well, he pointed to that golden rule that Brother Sonny Rollins highlighted. How would I want to be treated if I were undergoing the same situation by the authorities in place? And there's something about the moral and spiritual gravitas of that golden rule that cuts through all the superficial mess and gets at our rich humanity, no matter how debased at times it appears to be.
And hopefully it keeps us as healthy as a herd, really, right? Because, you know, the more we all are healthy, the more healthy we all are. You know, it's sort of a circular matter. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, circle mm-hmm. of life. Yeah. Well, it's always a pleasure, you know, Cornell. Yeah. It's just a joy. Thank you so much for everything and for office hours today. We've come to the end of our episode, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed it. We had a great time. That's our standard. Did we have a great time?
We always have a good time.
And we always do.
Thank you, Sister Tricia. Thank you, Sister Tricia.
My pleasure. And everyone out there, join us wherever you want. We're on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And don't forget to subscribe on YouTube so you'll know when the next episode's coming and get some advance warning. And join us forever and always on the tightrope. Thank you.